Hello, everybody, and salam. I'd like to acknowledge the Gadigal people of the Eora nations, and pay my respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Can you hear me clearly?
No, not really.
Should I use two?
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
So my name is Tasneem Samak, and I got to be part of this project as a co-author alongside Dr. Rayyan, and of course Dr. Randa Abdul Fattah, and next to me Sophie Rudolph. It's been a huge inspiration and honor to work together on this project as the authors. And yeah, I just wanted to give a shout out to Dr. Randa Abdul Fattah for bringing us together to examine the testimonies that came through the register, and also to thank APAN for setting up this anti-Palestinian racism in schools register. So the way that we want to do this panel is really a reflection of how this school register came about. So it did come about from community, and it was community, as Dr. Rayyan explained, that said we want somewhere where we can report these instances and these experiences that have heightened since October 7. And so APAN responded to that by setting up this register, because we thought that it would be important to understand and also acknowledge the distinction of this experience, which is what we're terming anti-Palestinian racism. But I think even that language is insufficient, as Paul from the MUA was speaking to, of really grasping what is actually occurring in our schools and in our society in response to the Gaza genocide. So this is kind of for us an entry point into seeing and hearing these testimonies. And that's why we've set up this panel in this way. So next to me, each person will introduce themselves, but we have teachers, we have school staff and representatives. We have a student, Zakaria, here, and Ramzi, who's a parent as well. And they will be bringing these perspectives forward, because really, when we're talking about anti-Palestinian racism, from our perspective as the researchers, it's about situating that from a lived experience point of view, and understanding how lived experience is actually unique knowledge and insight. So rather than doing research from a kind of, quantitative and objective and positivist point of view, the research that I do in my studies, but also the team does, is actually understanding racism through studying it from experience. And that way we have insight into systems and structures, rather than thinking about racism as some kind of, aberrational experience where it's, interpersonal, and it begins at that level and ends at that level. We wanted to really show how this is playing out in subtle ways, but also in very harmful ways that affect individuals, but are rooted in systems, in ideologies that are made dominant and that are protected and endorsed by those in power. And there's no one better to speak to that than the people who make up schools, the teachers and students and staff, and of course us who are in the education sector as educators. And so we invite all of you here to join us as people who are also very much invested in education, not only as receivers of education, but actually participants and people who are determining the direction of education in our society. And we will have that open Q&A at the end, where we want to hear from you as those who are working in this sector about your insights also into anti-Palestinian racism. But yeah, I'll hand over to Dr. Sophie, who will share a few thoughts and maybe respond to some questions. Mainly, I wanted to ask you, as an education scholar, how your experience has been in engaging in the testimonies that came forward through the register and, on working on this project.
Hi, thanks, Tasneem. I want to say thank you. I'm also honoured to be part of this project and to have heard the stories and to try to make sense of those stories in the kind of broader educational, social and political context. I am a non-Indigenous person. I have European Anglo settler heritage. And I've been grown up in this country by First Nations people. They have taught me how to understand this country, how to understand our history, and how to understand the fight for justice, and how to be in solidarity in that fight, in that struggle. How to understand racism in this report. So, building a bit on what you were talking about, Tasneem, in terms of the kind of structural elements of this, it was really important to us as the authorship team to think about anti-Palestinian racism as connected to settler colonialism. And this is important because Australia and Israel are both settler colonial states as well. And so in the report and in some other work that I've done with colleagues in a book called Learning Whiteness, we engaged with First Nations scholar Aileen Morton Robinson's theorisation of the settler colonial state as being invested in white possessive logics, so in white possession. And this means that the state seeks to assert its racial dominance through possession of land, language, knowledge and history as white. And this requires dehumanisation of Indigenous and other racialised minorities to maintain this narrative of superiority. And it's a false narrative, as we all know, but this is the kind of structural manifestation of this investment of the settler colonial state in racial domination. And what this does is it also produces in the settler state rage and backlash when this narrative of white possession and superiority is challenged or threatened. And this can produce harsh disciplinary responses that are aimed to protect that white domination. This is the state working through its institutions, so through education, to uphold racial domination and to protect whiteness and white superiority. And so we see this happening in the testimonies that students, teachers and family members shared with the APAN Register. And in particular, I'll just highlight a couple to kind of make those connections and those links and build on what Ryan also shared. So backlash towards teachers in particular came in the form of directions to be neutral or objective in their teaching, and that mention of Palestine and Israel's genocidal actions, they were told breached this idea of teachers and teaching being neutral and objective. But we know that teaching is never neutral and objective, and particularly in a settler colonial state. That is just not possible. We also saw that punitive discipline was used against both students and teachers through measures such as banning, confiscating, and suspending. And this is a way of making the other the problem and individualising. So Paul talked at the beginning about how racism damages our capacity to be collective, and this occurs through these kind of disciplinary measures which individualise and other. This is rather than seeing the system as set up to protect settler colonial narratives and white dominance. And finally, the idea of prioritising social cohesion, which was a broader public discourse as well, as we know, came through in the testimonies where teachers and students were silenced or asked to self-censor to maintain this illusion of social cohesion. And again, this contributes to turning away from systemic injustices and sees Palestinians and those in solidarity with them as less worthy of a voice and a place in the school. And ultimately, it upholds a colonial system of racial domination. I think it's really important to us as authors to see these experiences of racism, as Tasneem said, and Ryan as well, not just as victim, you know, being victimized, also as expressions of resistance to the settler colonial state's actions of oppression. And so that's the way that we're kind of trying to situate these understandings.
Thanks heaps. To help us better understand, I guess, and inform the direction of how we can address anti-Palestinian racism in schools, we also invited Dr. Samara, who will introduce herself. Dr. Samara co-founded the National Indigenous Youth Education Coalition, and a big part of the work that they do is dealing with, of course, the racism that Indigenous youth are subjected to. And so we thought maybe you could share with us some of your insights from establishing that coalition and where the work is at and how it parallels with some of what you're hearing today.
Yeah.
Oh. Thank you. Hello everyone. Yeah, my name's Samara and I'm a proud Warramai Biripi woman. And I'm here as a co-founder of the National Indigenous Youth Education Coalition, which is a youth-led organization that really came about 10 years ago when a bunch of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students from around Australia got together on Ngunnawal country in Canberra to kind of discuss our vision for education. And the drive for that was that many of us had experienced racism in school in different forms, whether that was kind of directly racist comments or just feeling really not seen in curriculum materials or that kind of thing. But then really kind of painting a vision for where we wanted education to go. And so we've done a number of kind of projects over the years. I mean, we really just started out as a bunch of young people doing things in our spare time. We all had full-time jobs or were studying, and so we were trying to lead campaigns on the side. And so I think there's a number of things that we've learnt as a collective over the years. And I mean, I think one of the prime lessons is the importance of community and collectivity. We started really as like a group of five that were kind of really driving it, and that has grown now to an entire organization with like 8 employees, but we also have a huge network of supporters in all different sectors, education sector, you know, university, government, not-for-profit, that are really kind of supporting and backing our work, which has been really, really incredible to see. There's definitely parallels in terms of, you know, the things that are highlighted in this report. One of the big pieces that NIAC has done, which was a kind of a truth-telling project, was highlighting the history of school exclusion of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students continue to be disproportionately excluded today, so they're more likely to be suspended or expelled than other students. But we wanted to highlight that that's kind of a systemic issue, that it's been an issue since the very beginning of our education system. In fact, in the 1920s, we had an exclusion on demand policy here in New South Wales that said, basically, if a non-Indigenous parent complained, an Indigenous student would be excluded from the school. And of course, you know, we don't have those kind of policies anymore, but there still continue to be a lot of negative experiences of Indigenous students. And I think truth-telling is really important to highlight that because, and through those lived experiences, so such as the stories that are included in this report, because I think it really highlights that this is not kind of an abstract or distant issue, that it's, you know, it's happening now and it's really, and how it affects people. And then I think linking in with that, I've kind of, I'm also like a researcher at university, and so I've done a lot of research on how the education system has been used sort of as a tool of genocide. And I mean, here we have a very well-documented history of how schools were used to assimilate Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students. And so I think that really highlights and speaks back to this, you know, idea of schools being politically neutral places. They are certainly not. They've been very politically active and purposeful places. So I see a lot of synergies in kind of the issues that are highlighted across the work that NIAC's done and also in this report. And I think one of the key lessons, though, that I would share from NIAC's work is, highlighting and doing this truth-telling work is one step. And I think after truth-telling needs to come kind of the healing and justice, right? Things need to actually change. And that's where, as a community, kind of setting out your vision, such as the recommendations that are included in here, and kind of what do we need, what does things need to actually look like for everyone to feel safe? Because fundamentally, what we're talking about at the end of the day, whether it's for Palestinian students and allies, or for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students, is our right to exist. And that is a basic human right that every single person has. And so I think there's highlighting, doing this work, I think also is really important because it builds those bridges. One thing, and I think Sophie pointed to this, is racism can divide people. But I think when we call it out, that's also a way to unite us together again in fighting against this struggle of racism within the settler colonial state. I'll leave it there.
Yeah. Thank you. So to help inform those recommendations, as you're saying, Samara, we have Zakaria, who is a student of Palestinian heritage. His father was born in Jordan and his mother in Iraq after both families were displaced from Palestine. Growing up in Australia, Zakaria always carries his heritage with pride and continues to educate his peers about issues in Palestine. But we also have Ramzi with us as well, who importantly brings that parent perspective. And we know that parents are partners in children's education, and that's how we want schools to approach parents. So Ramzi is the son of Nakba survivors, a husband and father of three, two of which attend schools. He's born and raised in Sydney, and he works in construction management. So we wanted to hear from both of you, maybe Zakaria first, about, I guess, your experiences in this heightened climate of anti-Palestinian racism, how that's been in the education space, and your thoughts about that for, other students and other people of a Palestinian background, but also others affected by anti-Palestinian racism.
Yeah, thanks, Tasneem. I've been in government schooling from about year 6 to year 12, and especially before October 7th, there wasn't much talking about the issues in Palestine. However, October 7th did spark a big controversy of the issues in Palestine, and when that issue began, I began to wear a pin that says "Free Palestine and the Israeli occupation," and that did spark up a little bit of a conversation between me and YPs of the issues in Palestine and how we have the right to be educated and to go to school. We have that routine of waking up in the morning and go to school, whereas those Palestinian students or the ones that live in Palestine, they don't have that basic human right anymore of education. And I did wear that pin to school, and I was actually spoken to by one of my principals, and I was asked to remove the pin because apparently it actually it sparked an issue of making hate within the school. And look, fortunately for me, I come from a very educated background where my mother and my father are both educated, and we were able to defend ourselves in this situation because they wanted to take the pin off me, they wanted to strip me of my identity. We did speak to the school in regards to that one, and we were luckily able to get that decision withdrawn. Yes. I'm wearing my heritage, my identity. That's who I am, and it did leave a little bit of a bitter taste. And for me, look, another big experience was on graduation, obviously, you see lots of students, you know, they're wearing their cultural attire, and everyone's celebrating that, and no one has an issue with that. I, like many other students, did want to wear my cultural attire, so I actually wore a Palestinian kufi, and there was no issue during the graduation, thankfully. But after which, I was actually told by one of my deputy principals that I was just trying to seek attention, you know, like it wasn't an attempt to, you know, share my heritage. It was an attempt to you know, seek attention from other students, and, you know, didn't really leave a tasteful experience for me. But thank God, there was no issues after that, and thankfully, it's my experience.
Yeah, so I'm a father of two school-age kids. And to give a little bit of context to this experience, I want to go from the start. When you're a parent of Palestinian kids, you've got to make a decision that not everyone has to make. Are you going to raise your kids to be activists? Are you going to push that on them? Are you going to tell them they need to start being activists actively? Or are you going to let that happen organically? Because it's going to happen. It's going to happen. I made the decision to let them be kids for as long as possible. I never encouraged them to be activists. I let them develop organically. I let them ask questions, you know, like my daughter, for example, she learned about the Nakba and the mass displacement simply when she asked me. She's like, Dad, if we're Palestinian, why did we come to Australia? And the conversation flows from there. And she, you know, she, that's how she learned about her identity. So trying to raise kids who are kids and try to let them learn about being Palestinian and what that means organically. And that all changed for me one day when it actually happened when it was Harmony Day was coming up, and every year of primary school, my daughter had decided to wear a thobe to school, which is traditional Palestinian garment with beautiful patterns on it. And this year in particular, she decided that she didn't want to wear it. And then I asked her why she didn't want to wear it. And then she said, oh, well, you know, a month back, a teacher had tapped her on the shoulder when they noticed Palestinian badges on her school bag and said to her, hey, be careful with those badges. You might upset someone. That was disappointing. I suppose that was the inevitable induction into Palestinian activism that I didn't want my daughter to have. She kept it to herself, which was a bit sad, and it definitely affected her self-expression, you know, her pride in her identity, something which, you know, she was looking for all the good things about being Palestinian, enjoying the fashion, the food, the dancing, the music, and her right to enjoy all of that was taken away with her in one of the most innocuous and subtle ways you could ever imagine, you know, like this act, it was subtle. It was covert, it was quick, yet it was so strong. It was such an effective way to repress identity and even to dehumanize, you know, and basically to say to a Palestinian child, you, don't be Palestinian.
Thanks so much for sharing that. I have two little boys as well who are in primary school, and these experiences really resonate. And I think what stands out, I think, about the testimonials that we're hearing is that, yeah, it's at the level of such, I don't know if we'll call it subtle or like really benign, but, you know, like a lanyard, you know, a sticker, and then the reaction that it receives is so heightened. And I think that's what people in the register are trying to kind of point to, that is racism there, because it's the racism that heightens the reaction. It's all of these associations with it that then, compel somebody to approach a child about, you know, something like a watermelon. So obviously this is loaded, and there's a lot that's happened before that instance to drive somebody to
to want to kind of, you know, suppress it in some way. And I think that's where we would like to hear from you, Chris, and Amber as well, because, Chris, you've been working with teachers and school staff for Palestine, and Amber is the deputy president of the New South Wales Teachers Federation. I would like to hear your insights into, I guess, how this is manifesting and how that is working in schools within, I guess, the narratives of harmony, social cohesion that we've been talking about, and how schools understand racism and why they're missing these kinds of instances or not necessarily counting them as actually instances of harm.
Maybe I could start. I'm really proud to be here alongside public school students, parents, and of course academics. And can I just say, for the two youth speakers, there is great hope, isn't there, for the future of this nation, thankfully. Look, the Federation has been very, very clear in its position around Palestine. It is the only union that has had its flags publicly on every Sunday rally for nearly 2 years now. The only union. Unfortunately, what this research highlights is we've got a long way to go with our members. I won't comment at this point on the Department of Education's policies because that would be a them problem and us problem. Yeah. But certainly the union has a really significant role to play in ensuring that that harm does not continue. And I acknowledge from the report that the behaviour of many teachers, it's clear. One only hopes they're not members of the Teachers Federation. But the behaviour of many teachers is totally inappropriate, ununion and unpublic school. We have a charter of teachers' work, which was developed by our state council and our members. And that charter goes to 9 really clear things that is teachers' work, 8 of which go to the core of their teaching work, but one is very clear. It is that teachers must be active and engaged citizens. And we do that on purpose. And it describes our roles as professionals in the classroom, with workers, with other unions, and to stand to grow not only the profession, but public education and the public good. Because we know that we have a really, really critical role on the front line, actually, of the manifestation of racism, but also a great responsibility to be able to work to eliminate it. We are the microcosms in public schools of our communities. And that means that we have a heightened, I believe, a greater responsibility to work towards its eradication, as we have done through our history. Thank you.
Thanks. My name's Chris Breen. I'd like to acknowledge that I'm speaking on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation, whose fight for justice continues today, just like the fight for justice in Palestine. I mean, sadly, the examples here are not something that we haven't come across in teachers and school staff of Palestine. And I don't think it's a case of schools missing these incidents. I actually think that schools are driving them. You have to understand that the policies come from the top. So the MINS, the policy about being neutral in schools comes from the MINS government, which is not neutral. It lit the Opera House for Israel. And MINS has said again and again, Israel has the right to defend itself as if this is what's happening in Gaza. And this policy comes because they want their politics to dominate in the classroom. It's political interference in the classroom. And that flows down then to principals. So there are at least 5 schools that we're aware of where principals came in on the first day of term and said to all of the staff, you can't talk about Gaza in the classroom. Anything about Gaza has to come through them. And so you get the consequences of that. I mean, one of the most egregious examples, I mean, was, he's here, was Amel Hajj, who was working at Sydney Girls High School, a Palestinian-Australian teacher. He wore his keffiyeh for 4 months without incident until he was taken into a meeting with his principal and told he couldn't wear it anymore. He was then forced to work. He refused to do that. He was then had to walk from an office outside of the school, faced months of harassment, and eventually resigned. He appealed that decision about working from the office several times, and that was upheld by the head of education, Murat Dizdar. So again, this is not just a question of individual teachers or students being racist. It's a policy because I think the West is backing the genocide in Israel, and that's where I think it stems from. When you're trying to hide a genocide that's happening in full public view, being visibly Palestinian becomes a problem. You know, the narrative about terrorism, Hamas, and people take up from that as well.
Absolutely.
Oh, sorry, Harmony Day, you mentioned. There's about 10 schools that we're aware of. Harmony Day is traditionally, it used to be the International Day for Racial Elimination of Racial Discrimination before John Howard changed it. But in schools, students traditionally dress up in their cultural gear as a celebration of multiculturalism. But we're aware of 10 schools, probably more than that, where students were told they're not allowed to bring the Palestinian flag, they're not allowed to wear Palestinian colours, and this is on a multiculturalism anti-racist day. It's outrageous.
Thank you for speaking to these nuances. And that's also something we tried to bring about in the report as well. So we situated it in the Gaza genocide and emphasized that even as Zakaria said, you know, there's the before and there's the after. And we also tied it to the studies on Islamophobia, which, you know, inform us a lot about how this has been manifesting as well, so since September 11. So some of the research that I was doing, you know, before this project is on the 9/11 generation, and specifically understanding what the 9/11 generation is, which is, you know, a generation of Muslims who grew up in the shadow of the war on terror. And now we're kind of speaking about the Gaza generation, a generation that is, you know, navigating again, like a renewed, but also on the back of, you know, 20 years. And then, as Rayanne said, you know, centuries of Orientalism and Eurocentricism and Western Empire. But really, you know, 9/11 was a moment that, you know, we saw that kind of manufactured Islamophobia. So that's kind of what we mean by systemic. And then again, here we're seeing the way that racism is deployed, as Chris was saying, to achieve certain political objectives. And that all can come through as something as kind of, collecting testimonies. And I think that's why the research, when it has these kinds of imperatives, can bring that story forward, that we want to speak about racism, but we want to do this contextualizing work to situate it in the workings of empire. And I wanted to bring Sophie back in to speak about this, and Samara as well, because that's kind of what we're trying to do in the education space at the moment, right? To acknowledge the roots of this and the kind of international and imperial factors that are, yeah. And that schools need to kind of work with that as part of their anti-racism policies, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe we'll just wait for them to swap.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so one of our recommendations is around creating more literacy of Palestine and of history. So I think that history is really important because one of the tools of settler colonialism is that it wants to erase history, and it wants, so, and we've seen that happen in terms of seeing, you know, depicting this genocide. Sorry, it's not working.
Is it on or not?
Yeah. I think it's on.
Yeah.
That's not on. Sorry.
Okay.
Sorry about that. Now it's on. Apologies. So I was just saying that I think historical literacy is really important because one of the techniques of settler colonialism is to try and erase history or distort history. And we can see that in the way that genocide has been depicted as a war and as beginning on October 7. And we can see that in terms of First Nations history as well, and this idea of, say, celebrating Australia Day, where we know that actually that history of that day is one of invasion and dispossession, but also of survival, you know, so really important to sort of think about these histories, and also what is occurring, I think, in schools as both narratives of or experiences of harm, as well as of refusal or resistance. So that's another. So another thing that Samara and I share is some work on school exclusion, as Samara was talking about before. Often the reasons that young people are excluded from school, they are seen as the problem and they're seen as being harmful. But often these can also be expressions of refusal of a system that is oppressive and violent. And so I think it's about how we kind of understand what is happening and work together to kind of address that.
Yeah, thanks, Sophie. Yeah, I think building on that, I think our struggles are, it's a shared struggle in this need for truth-telling, and I think one of the challenges that we have, and we're seeing this, I think, manifest in, the government's complicit in genocide in Gaza, but I think one of the challenges for Australian society in trying to kind of grapple with what's happening is also because we haven't fully grappled with our own colonial history, and so how can we grapple with, you know, the colonization of another country and call it out in the same way when we've not been able to do that as a country? And so I think that struggle for like truth-telling and justice is really intertwined. And I think until we see that, and we know we have a long way to go because of the amount of racism that came out around the lead up to the referendum, there is a long way to go in that. And I think until we do have kind of really systematic truth-telling, which is why, you know, history and history curriculum is really important and teaching these things in schools is really important. Because I think until we have that kind of mature, frank, honest conversation, it's a challenge, I think, actually move forward and get to the kind of justice and healing part. Truth telling is part of that, but it will kind of only get us so far.
Yeah, absolutely. I might bring it back to Zakaria and Ramsey. Just make sure that the mic is on. But yeah, in terms of the recommendations, some of what we discuss in the report is, I guess, some changes that schools can make. And I wanted to ask you from your perspective, what would be the value of having more space to express both Palestinian perspectives, but also identity in schools?
I'll go first. Sorry, the question is, what would
What would be, from your view, why is that valuable and important for us to arrive at that change where there is that kind of critical space to discuss Palestine at school?
It's suppressed right now, and so that's the first step in ending repression is having that open, honest conversation about what happened and what it is. I get these questions about Palestine all the time. Sorry, people find it an immensely interesting subject as well. You know, it's a good way to engage kids in other worldly topics, and yeah. So that's my feedback. Yeah, it's a good subject, and it's the first step of breaking down anti-Palestinian racism.
Yeah.
Look, with that one, 100% agree with Ramsey on that one. I think that it is also pretty important that, you know, it is talked about within schools and everything like that. The first step with that one would probably be
more recognition of the issue within schools. Like, you know, if it's actually talked about in, for example, history classes and all that stuff, where, you know, like how we spoke about the issues that happened all across the world in Sudan, in Germany and everything like that. I think that if we speak about that one in history classes and all that stuff, students actually get to see what's happened in the past and what's still going on now with that one. So it's a pretty important first step.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah, the reason why I think I asked that question is because often we think about it as, you know, okay, it's to alleviate harm, but actually there's educative value, right? There's educative value of having this as, you know, official curriculum. And it's actually, even if it's not official curriculum, it's already there. Like, kids are talking about it, and it's an important question of, well, what is the role of schools within that? And of course, we're living at the moment in a time where the Australian curriculum is really complex, and it's making all kinds of, you know, commitments like multiculturalism. Of course, we're supposed to be in this like post-racial era, but also, you know, commitments to a diverse curriculum, to teaching Asia, to all these things, and then we're having these manifestations of very heightened racism, which some of the testimonies speak to that sense of like shock, I guess. And I think what Chris is saying is that it's not a contradiction. It's very much, you know, comes together. And some of the questions from the audience speak to that. So I might give that, read out some of these questions and keep it open. But maybe Chris and Amber, you want to speak to this?
Can I add a little bit to the truth telling?
You can do that while I choose the questions.
I do think that truth telling is really important. Like, students are hungry to understand the world, often more so than teachers. And as Miranda Abdel-Fadda put it very well at one meeting, they can go from watching the genocide live streamed on their phones to being told that they can't talk about it in the classroom. And I do think that that is really important. One of the big things that neither the Department of Education will do or the government will do is actually call it genocide. You know, we can say 1 + 1 = 2, but we can't say intent plus mass killing equals genocide. And I think that's a really important thing. Victorian teachers currently have an open letter to their education department that they're trying to get published in a newspaper, calling to remove the restrictions and to be able to support Palestinian human rights. If you go to our social media, you can see we've got our own open letter calling for the department to tell the truth and to remove restrictions on teachers to be able to talk about these things in a safe space in the classroom.
Can I just talk more broadly about the safe space? I think that's really important. Teachers have to resist. I mean, that's the reality. Teachers who want to talk about, you know, anti-racism and Palestinian anti-racism should be able to do so and should be encouraged to do so. And when people direct them, they need to come to the union so that we can collectively fight that. There is nothing worse than an individual trying to fight, but rather a collective moment in schools. Just while I've got the mic, I want to address the issue of apolitical, because that is an absolute farce in public schools. Any politician of all sorts of persuasion uses our schools, because they are our schools, they belong to teachers, not to the government, we believe. Our schools are used for all sorts of political announcements, with kids in the background nodding, whether that be a new building or a new school upgrade or AI or a launch of something else. They use our schools. They are the most political with public education than any other. Teachers also are not able to be non-political. Every single thing that a teacher does is a political action, and we are proud that that is the case. It is a political decision how many students are in your class. It is a political decision how many resources public schools get. It is a political decision how much release from face-to-face or how, what curriculum you teach. They are all political decisions. So I think we should just agree collectively that they are highly politicised public schools, and we are proud of that. But we do have to give teachers the confidence to push back against that. Thank you.
I think that's really important, because actually when schools are trying to be apolitical, they're often failing the different demographics. So it doesn't serve, you know, Jewish students when schools are apolitical. It doesn't serve Palestinian students either, or any racialized subjects, right? And we know this. I teach in the education courses at university, so part of my work, and I think Sophie as well, you know, we train the pre-service teachers and we speak to them before they go out to schools, and it's very much that at the moment, which is, education is not neutral, it's a political profession, and it has a history as well. Like, schools were founded on ideas of conformity, on like the factory model and colonization. And that brings in one of the main questions here we have, which is, I guess, given all of this, you know, what are some of the practical things that can bring these recommendations to light and can push for change within schools so that schools can run in a drastically transformed way where they're serving different objectives? And I'll open that question to all of you. So, how do you see that transformation happening in schools?
In terms of what we can do, there's always two things, what we say and what we do. What we say, this report is really important. Everybody who's here, if you're in a school, please take copies, leave them around the staff room, get them into your school. I'm a proud Fed member. I'd love to see bits of this report in the next education magazine. I'd like to see, you know, people like Ramsey or Wasim come and speak to Union Council about their experience or associations. The other thing, as Amber said, is collective resistance. Some of the best examples of pushing back against anti-Palestinian racism have been collective. At one school, I won't name it, but there are two teachers here where they were told they weren't allowed to wear the kefir. They won support from their local union branch and they wore it en masse. 12 of them into school, and there was nothing that the school could do. I mean, perhaps the other... Perhaps the other great example, people would have heard about the case of Sheikh Wasim Shekawi, who was suspended from his school support officer role for comments he made on his private social media about selective moral outrage. I think he probably would have lost his job if it was not for the support he got from the school community. There were 300 students, parents, teachers who protested outside the front, and he was reinstated after that. And I think we need to see more of that. We need people to know about that example.
I'm particularly interested, this is not the only recommendation, but I'm particularly interested in how we can pursue the uncomfortable pedagogies.
Yes.
I think that is a really great pathway forward. I know many of our teachers across the syllabuses, for example, use topics around rights and freedoms to teach all sorts of things. I'm sure you've all heard the joke, why is teaching the best profession in the world? Because the state pays you to undermine it. The reality is we have to do that a little bit more. There is plenty in the curriculum that allows the scope to teach these struggles, to teach these anti-racism for our Aboriginal and Indigenous brothers and sisters, but also for our Palestinian students. They are there. The Federation has a website for members where they publish resources, curriculum, research all around anti-racism. But we in the union have to do more too. We have to train our teachers, much like we did many, many years ago, around racism with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander students, so that teachers feel confident and don't just walk past. It is not always the case that they don't agree, they just don't often know how to tackle it. So we have a responsibility in the union to lift our teachers up.
Wow.
I actually do agree with what you said in that one. I think that teachers should be open to say what they believe in, because I've actually had a few instances in the past where I've obviously been very vocal in the classroom about my stance on the issue in Palestine and what's going on over there. I've had a few teachers. I've had a few teachers, you know, kind of. Thank you. I've had a few teachers kind of, you know, shush me in the classroom, but then, like, after the class, they'll come and they'll sit and they'll talk to me and they'll say, "Look, I completely agree with you. I see the issue. I see all of that, but you know, we can't obviously speak about that in classrooms." Now, obviously, the reason why some of our classes may be a little bit misinformed is because we actually can't speak about this in the classroom. I think it's an important step in, you know, seeing the issues around us. And
everyone's scared.
I believe you can talk about it in the classroom, and you should.
We'll give it to Sophie.
I just want to say I agree with all of these things, and I think connecting them, it's about teachers and students working in solidarity and working collectively to change these things. And critical pedagogies and pedagogies of discomfort are mechanisms in which to do that work, that collective, solidaristic kind of work, and to unsettle power. And that's the intent behind them, is to be able to speak truth to power, to learn about structures of oppression and how we can collectively work towards liberating ourselves from those structures. So I think it's really important what you've, both teachers and students, have said here about being able to do that work together.
Thank you for that. I have another question here. I don't know, Ramsey, if you wanted to respond to this, but I guess it's asking, how can we create safe spaces that allow our children and their teachers some freedom from, I guess, the dominant ideologies? So maybe from your perspective as a parent, what are some of the things that you're doing to kind of ensure a little bit of safety for your children as they're growing up in this context?
So to ensure safety, reassurance of my kid, letting them know that, you know, there's nothing wrong with being Palestinian. They've got the right to enjoy their culture. But I suppose the most important thing, touching on the question before this and this one, is solidarity is everything. The solidarity of the people around you. So I encourage my kids to talk to their friends about being Palestinian and what we deal with, just so that their friends know, so that they start building solidarity around them, and, you know, encouraging not just awareness of issues, but encouraging solidarity and encouraging people to not be worried about who they're going to offend if they stand with right. Okay, saying no to genocide, saying no to oppression is right. So just do it. Don't worry who supports that genocide, who supports that oppression. Solidarity and stand on the right side and be proud of that, regardless of who might disagree with you.
The solidarity is really important. One of the things that I think has reopened up the conversation in schools was the 300,000 people marching across the bridge. After that, there were students who asked me, did I go on the march? They wanted to go on the march in ways that hadn't happened for a while. So I think that was really important. But I do think the bigger thing is actually a political fight to change the directions and restrictions on teachers, to change the formal rules so that their teachers don't have to feel nervous about talking about it in the classroom. I mean, Amber's right that we should resist, but we shouldn't have to have these restrictions placed upon us either.
Yeah, absolutely. What I was going to turn to is that question of solidarity, and I guess how schools can be sites of solidarity, as we're seeing. So although some of these incidences that we have in the testimonials do show victimization, it's important to acknowledge that, you know, in this moment, Palestinians are victims, because post October 7,
part of why there's been so much, you know, anti-Palestinian racism and violence is this villainization of the Palestinian, this view that, you know, Palestinians are solely perpetrators in this, you know, post-October 7 narrative. And of course, that's not at all accurate. And part of the suppression and the silencing is wanting to skirt around that, like how can Palestinians be victims in this moment, you know? But of course, the testimonies speak to solidarity. So we see in some of the examples, it's teachers who've noticed, you know, a child has been instructed not to wear their sticker. And then it's the teacher who's reported it in the register and said, like, I witnessed this, I didn't know what to do about it, but this concerned me. So these are like, you know, seedlings of what we're speaking about. We also have, you know, parents saying that, oh, my you know, daughter's teacher was very pro-Palestine, and although, you know, my daughter's been experiencing a lot of difficulty at school, that was reassuring for her. So that does come through. And I guess some of the questions here are about further research. So I might give it to, you know, Samara and Sophie to speak to that, because, where do you think this can go in terms of not only understanding anti-Palestinian racism, but what future directions do you see from these testimonies and how they can guide us? So maybe Sophie first, or Samara, do you want to go first?
Thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think for research, I think there is space to think about how people are resisting. So to look at the ways in which people are gathering together and are resisting, and how that can be engaged and supported. But I think there, as Chris has said, I think there's a political element to the change as well, and research is can't do everything, and our political will and fight has to be a part of that picture too. And so using this research as a way of pushing that that political fight forward, and resourcing a public education system that can do this work, and transforming a system that is individualistic and competitive into one in which we can work together and we can do this kind of critical work, I think is really important.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with what Sophie said. I think while there's sort of more research that could potentially be done, I think it's about turning the research that we have into tangible action and trying to get some kind of political change, you know. And we're going to do that as a collective, as a community. So trying to, you know, influence policy changes at government level, if that's what we need to do. Because all the examples that we've had of community and resistance, I think, show that when we band together, we can get change. So I think it's about taking these recommendations and doing what we can as a community to, you know, call on your local school principal to make a change, or write letters to the Department of Education, that kind of thing. We have to take this and do something with it, you know, turn it into action research.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's kind of what we want to see as well. We want to see people taking this back to their schools, hopefully opens more doors to speaking about the issue, but then also, you know, school communities coming together and saying, okay, well, if this is a problem for our school, then how can we all, you know, as parents, as teachers, as staff, and also, most importantly, you know, students as active participants in transformation within their own school community, which is a radical vision for what schools can be. And we've seen examples of this, you know, internationally, some people are asking about, but we've seen that with, you know, anti-Black racism, like Black Lives Matter movement, how it translated into real life programs within schools, within communities where there's large demographics of, you know, Black students. And so this can begin, especially in schools where there is a high demographic of, you know, Arab, Muslim and affected communities, at the very least. And some questions here about teacher education programs, and I think that's quite vital. So that could be, you know, its own kind of dimension within the research. And here we also have a question about the recent decision in the Latouf case. And I think that's maybe a good point to kind of wrap up on, because the register data that we worked with kind of was between March and July 2024. But of course, a lot has changed since then. The genocide has escalated, but we've also seen, the march on the Harbour Bridge, Australia's recognition of Palestine, more openness, like, to discuss the genocide from the United Nations. And so it would be interesting to see if that's actually created some more space within schools, or whether it's as heightened as it was when, you know, this was kind of like the first impulse response post October 7 in the data that we've worked with. So there's I think what we get from tonight is that there are many directions to go with, and we would urge and advocate for our communities to resource this area of research and to get behind anti-Palestinian racism work, anti-Palestinian racism work, and to support, of course, APAN and the parents and the students and the community that is trying to tackle this issue. I want to thank all the panelists here tonight. I want to thank all the audience. I hope that you were able to post your questions and that we responded to them. But if not, you can always contact us, and you can contact APAN as well. Thank you so much.
To the panelists, thank you to Sneem for facilitating, and thank you to our wonderful Auslan interpreters, Lizzie and Amanda, for your efforts. Limited scope and space, we appreciate you always. Just final closing remarks. I'll be 2 minutes, folks. I know it's been a long Friday, but here we are. Just tonight, you know, we've witnessed the launch of the Anti-Palestinian Racism in Australian Schools report. But before I do that, my name is Noor Salman. I'm the new APR project manager. APR is Anti-Palestinian Racism. I'm going to sit here because I don't feel comfortable standing in front of you all like this, sorry. I'm the new Anti-Palestinian Racism Project Manager at APAN. We'll be working this year as a result of the findings of this report to expand our work further. But just a few closing remarks. So what we've seen, we've read, we've heard, we've seen and experienced firsthand the impacts of anti-Palestinian racism. And tonight we've got a glimpse into this insidious nature of anti-Palestinian racism on students, on parents, on teachers and school staff, only resulting in gaining considerable attention and urgent action. The silencing and intimidation of Palestinians and allies in education systems and elsewhere is inherently enabling the continuation of the genocide and ethnic cleansing of Palestinians, Palestinians, their lands and their peoples as a whole. So to this, we must rise up against and rise up against the fear-mongering, the prejudice, and raise our children to be critical thinkers, to be proud of their Palestinian roots and heritage, and for our allies to teach their children the same. We must go beyond surface-level multiculturalism and social cohesion and enable our children and involve our educators to be more in tune with the systemic racism and encourage the teachings of Indigenous cultures here and elsewhere. Not doing so is an erasure and denial of Indigenous struggles and self-determination. So what's next? APAN is embarking on expanding the work of the Anti-Palestinian Racism in Schools Register by creating and launching a wider scope register across sectors in the coming months. This is an important opportunity for the community as a whole to contribute to this, to raise more awareness on the anti-Palestinian racism. I call it endemic, systemic racism, and it's very profound and we need to adjust to it. APAN is also looking to create resources on anti-Palestinian racism, targeting a range of audiences in various sectors and key stakeholders. It's seeking to develop and implement a community education program on anti-Palestinian racism, and engaging targeted audiences in developing their understanding of anti-Palestinian racism. Through these endeavours, we collectively will enable policy and practice change, something that we all spoke about tonight, and how to combat this insidious form of racism as part of a fundamental pursuit for human rights, justice, and growth in anti-racism strategies. So thank you to each and every single one of you for coming tonight. Thank you once again to our panelists, to our interpreters, and everybody here. Together, collectively, we can make a difference. In the meantime, if you come across any incidences or want to share or want to contribute towards future research, please do email APR, that's Alpha Peter Romeo, at apan.org.au, and we can start this work together as a collective. Thank you, everybody, and have a lovely, lovely evening. Thank you. Well done. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.